Marilyn Kring Productions in association with Emergent Life Studio presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2019. Lecture 4, delivered on August 29th.
Financial institution types and responsibilities. But first, we always look at the markets. Is this, ma'am, a good day or a bad day? So who is running the show today? The what? Bulls! In fact, this is a strong up day, and so the bulls are really happy. The bulls are absolutely ecstatic today. I mean, this is a serious up day. You would, if I were to bring a bull into the classroom, he would just be giddy. He would tell you about how wonderful everything is in the market now. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, I asked a bull to come today to talk to you. Give me a minute.
I don't know where the socks went.
Huh?
I don't know where the socks went. Oh. It was on the cow.
Hello.
So when do I come in?
Come in about 2 minutes.
2 minutes.
I am a bull. And there is no such thing as a bear market. As a matter of fact, if you've ever heard of bears, don't believe it. Bears are a myth. There's no such thing as a bear. The sky is the limit, and you can invest for the rest of your lives, and the stock market will go up, up, up. Now, do you believe me on that? Of course you do, because I am a bull. Moo. Now, when we say a bull market, this bull market has been going on for the last, what? 7-8 years. And there is no reason to believe all of these naysayers who say that there's going to be a market crash. As I said, there is no such thing as a bear. Moo? No, not the A1 sticks us! No, no! Ah. Ah, ah.
Moving along.
Where was I? Weirdest ass class I've ever taught. Financial institutions. Do you write checks?
No.
You know, I used to go out with a girl from Czechoslovakia, but my parents said no because they didn't accept checks. That's as good as it gets, Brian. You're going to have to laugh more. Have you ever written a check? You guys don't have checks, do you? You have debit cards. You have a checks? Okay, debit. Huh? I know, right? Actually, I've got my original set of checks that I was given when I opened an account years ago. It's just very rarely do we write checks, but they debit cards are essentially electronic checks. And those are actually called, when you put money into a financial institution, a bank, you are actually making what is called a demand deposit. A demand deposit means that you can go back in there and demand it. I want this now. Or someone who has a check you've written, I write you a check. You can walk into my financial institution and say, give me this. And with proper credentials, they will give you the money on demand. They cannot delay it. That means that these checks have the same liquidity, essentially, as currency. They are a very high tier. And in fact, you know, when you use your debit card, the liquidity is just rapid. It's instantaneous. These demand deposits are represented by checks and debit cards. Now, there's a thing here, and I really hate to do this, but when a bank takes in a check, you deposit $100 into your checking account. Now, what actually happens in terms of the accounting of that, and God, I don't want to do this, but okay, the bank debits at the bank. The bank debits $100, and at the same time, it credits its deposit liabilities. These are liabilities to the bank. That's how it works. Now, suppose the bank uses that money, and don't worry, this is as far as accounting as I care to go usually. Now, suppose that you go in and you ask for a loan from that bank. Well, then, interestingly enough, you want $100. Well, what the bank would then do is to the cash, and this is the cash at the bank. The bank would then debit $100 and loans in its portfolio. I'm sorry, credit $100 and then loans in its portfolio. It would match that with $100 asset. It now has an asset that is that loan. So interestingly enough, this all matches up, and that's the whole thing in accounting. Everything has to match. But behind this, and this, in my world, we really don't care too much about this, although we do want to keep an eye in financial institutions on their deposit liabilities here and how they relate as far as risk timing level to the loans that they have made with their depositors' money. Those loans are the bank's assets, and the matching liability is their depositors' money. Now, this is where it gets kind of interesting, because one of the places where I've placed people in the past that they really like to have us, they really like our majors here. They'll take several different majors, as long as you're not afraid of math, are the auditors for different places like the Federal Reserve, the Comptroller of the Currency, the FDIC. They have teams that just travel around their region and audit the banks. What their big thing that they're interested in is the quality of these assets versus the quality of the liabilities that they owe to their depositors. Because these have to be absolutely rock solid. You have to be able to meet your demand deposits whenever. But these banks sometimes get involved in loans that are really not very high quality, so that there is an imbalance in the risk that they would like to see between their loans, which are their assets, and their liabilities, which are the deposits. That comes out in practical terms in a bank in this area. you'll have some of the players from Chicago come down here to the sort of less sophisticated bankers in the area here, and they'll talk them into lending money for big fancy projects in Chicago. And it'll seem like, ooh, this is cool. We can diversify our portfolio. We can get involved in Chicago stuff, fancy apartments or whatever. And really, those are high-risk loans, and they just do not meet the quality as far as risk goes that these depositors expect for their money to be protected. And so you have those kinds of things. There are also other things as far as loans go. What kinds of loans are being made by the banks? Is there a portfolio diversification? In other words, are they lending all of their money to farmers or to new homeowners? They like to see sort of a spread so that there is a little bit of a suppression of risk because of the diversification of the portfolio assets. But here's the thing. I mean, let me get this off the board before I start getting creeped out by accounting, tea tables, and all of that. When I say check, that's a very specific term, interestingly enough. Are any of you in a credit union, ISU credit union, or something like that? Some of you are, I'm sure. Now, the thing is that a credit union is not a bank. A bank, technically, a BANK, is the only institution that can accept demand deposits and have checking accounts. Well, my credit union gives me checks. Not exactly. They look like it, and for all practical purposes, they act like it. However, they are not. So you would have one type of financial institution, would be your classic bank, and we might even call this a retail bank. It offers sort of different services, but it's mostly aimed at people and small businesses. In here, they are the place where you would make demand deposits. In other words, you can write checks against them. Now, a credit union is a fierce competitor with banks. As a matter of fact, if I were to bring in one of the big shots of one of the banks here in town or even in Peoria, or some of them up in Chicago, I am almost sure that one of the things in their little speech they would go on about is that they would bitch about credit unions. Because credit unions aren't banks. Credit unions get special preference as far as regulation and tax considerations go by acts of Congress. Credit unions do not have demand deposits. You cannot make a demand deposit. You cannot create a checking account. They'll call it that. They used to be told you can't do that. Now it's just like, who cares? But technically, what they offer you are what are called NOW accounts, negotiable order of withdrawal accounts. You, sir, would go to a bank and you get a checking account. Now, when you write me a check, I can walk into your bank and say, I want this money here now. I want it right away. And they would have to disgorge it immediately. Interestingly, though, if it was a credit union and I took your check to a credit union, technically they could say, okay, come back in 30 days and we'll give you your money, or 2 days, or 5 days. They probably would not do that, but they can. It is not true demand. In fact, and I don't know where the rule is on this now, what they give you are called checks with a Q-U-E-S instead of a C-K-S. That was the rule, is that they had to distinguish the actual spelling of the word. Hardly anyone even knew that, noticed that. It was just not something that you saw. The checks were checks. And I like corn Chex myself, but some people like the rice Chex or the wheat Chex. Too much fiber for me. But they are technically with a queue, and they could postpone payment of the money. So in other words, technically, they are not as liquid as checks, as demand deposits. So when our Federal Reserve, our central bank, which I'll talk to you about in a few lectures, distinguishes money by liquidity level, they start with just this pure base, M0. Almost no one ever talks about M0. It is just pure currency. It's, in other words, it's just paper and coins, dollar bills and coins. But then the next level, which almost always you hear us talk about, the one that's the first one that's mentioned, is M1, which is M0 plus demand deposits. And then, interestingly enough, historically, there was another one. And I don't know if I know that they are still used. Back in the past, they were very, very big. Have any of you ever used traveler's checks? Have you ever? They used to be big. There were advertisements with famous actors like Carl Malden on TV. Don't leave home without them. You would go to another country, and they would act just like money almost anywhere in the world. Plus, if you lost them, you could get the money back, or if they were stolen from you. So they put these in there too, travelers, and they use two L's, even though travelers checks, because they were so highly, highly liquid. They were essentially currency. So that was the next level of money. Now, then, as far as liquidity goes, and then slightly less liquid, M2, is M1, everything in M1, plus the now accounts. So they weren't as and we still do it that way. We still recognize that they aren't technically as liquid. Usually they are, but they don't have to be. And then they also put an M2, small time deposits. In other words, little certificates of deposits, CDs that mature in less than a year or something like that. And then finally, just to finish this off, there is a vast measure. It's called M3. It's M2 plus large, millions and millions of dollars time deposits. In other words, those ones that you can't touch the money without a serious penalty for early withdrawal for in the hundreds of millions of dollars. Small time deposits. And then the big one that has made over the past 25 years has made M3 just rocket upward. That's the euro dollars. Now, I said this before, and now I'm formalizing it. A euro dollar is money in a foreign bank's reserves. A euro dollar is money in a foreign bank's reserves. That's a euro dollar. So when you buy a car from Japan, ma'am, you get a car and the Japanese central bank gets your money. You buy it for $20,000, okay, in your case, $2,000. But you let's say about a $15,000 car. You get the car, you import a car, you export $15,000. Those don't end up with the manufacturer. They go to the Central Bank of Japan, which then gives the manufacturer the equivalent in yen. in that currency. Foreign manufacturers never get our money. They get what their central bank gives them as the equivalent in their currency. So all that money, all those American dollars, pile up in the central banks of these foreign countries. Those are the euro dollars. Trillions of them. Just trillions. Now, you can't spend the country's currency except in that country. That's how we get all of our loans from to run our government so badly. We borrow. This time, we walked into the treasury. We did a treasury auction last week, I think it was, to pay for $1 trillion we don't have that our government's going to spend. And how did that happen? Yeah, it was when you were very, no, just as when you were, before you were born and just after you were born, we had actually gotten rid of this problem. We were running surpluses. We were paying off our national debt. We were not borrowing money at all, certainly not from foreign governments. And then we claimed that there was this horrible recession in 2002, and we had to cut the taxes of the rich. And then we had a war in Iraq and a war in Afghanistan, and then the budget deficits just started getting worse from there. The Obama administration got hit when it came in 2009. It got hit because a huge amount of money had to pay to dig us out of the hole of what was a real horrendous recession. Then we started crawling out of the hole again, and then we got, oh, we got to have tax cuts for everyone. Of course, they were tax cuts for the rich, just like every time. And now we are running. We had to crawl to these governments for $1 trillion last week. And these were the same, of course, governments that we are calling, our current administration is calling filthy names and picking a fight in a trade war with the very countries that provide us with euro dollars to pay for what we can't pay for ourselves. So when you ask yourselves, wow, what should I do as far as being a prudent voter? Well, when they promise you candy, tax cuts, free college tuition, whatever, everything turned into a green world overnight, you say, well, where's that money going to come from? Well, it's going to come from these same people that it's been coming from all along, every time we're irresponsible. Go.
Why do they loan us that money if it's such a large amount?
What are they going to do with it?
Yeah, but I'm just like...
No, seriously, it's in their bank. They can't do anything with it but spend it here. That would be, that's all they can do. Well, there's the interesting thing. See, what I talked to you about, what I did with that, that was called the current account. Goods and services, money, trading. That's the balance of trade. In the long run, there is a mirror image of that. As the money comes back here from those foreign banks in long-term investments, in loans to us, and then what we exchange is commitments of our future money to them. So in other words, we're committing you. We get the money from the Chinese, the Japanese, the Canadians, the Saudis, and all those people. Well, yeah, that's great. And what we do in return is promise that this young man right here will pay it off down the road. And you will too. You, well, maybe not. You'll be a rich, famous guy, and you'll live in an island somewhere. But we're trading. See, the current account, I wrote several articles about this, and I found my articles on the Wayback Machine, so I should really post one of those. So in the current account, U.S., China, we get stuff, and they get U.S. dollars. That's the current account. That's what we call the balance of trade. And it's always negative for us. Now, why do the Chinese and the Japanese and the Saudis like to do this? Because they want those American dollars. Because investment in the United States has historically been probably better than any other investment in the world. Mainly because of our financial institutional framework. mainly also because of the rule of law, which applies here, and you can't find that in a lot of countries that you could invest in. That's one of the problems that I have with getting capital attracted to some of the countries that need this money. It's not enough for me to say, well, just peg your currency to the dollar and then the Chinese will invest there. No, you also have to have that institutional framework. Laws apply. Contracts are respected by the courts, absolutely. There is a law enforcement infrastructure that protects people's money and protects the investors. And there has to be transparency. You can't hide things from us. You can't lie to us. You can't tell us, well, this family is in charge and they don't like you to look at their books. We have to have all of those things in place. The United States historically has, so of course they're going to want, China and all these other countries are going to want American dollars so that they can invest them back here, where they are as good as possible and the investments are solid. That's where it all started, because we were so good about what we did. However, on the other hand, now you have that capital account, which is the mirror image of the current account. The capital account turns it around. Now remember, capital, long-term, money, short-term. So this is a current money account. This is its mirror image, the capital account, capital long-term. When what happens in that case is that China sends those dollars back here as loans to our government, loans to corporations, purchases of stock, money for your student loans in a secondary kind of way, secondary mortgage market kind of way, and in return, we send them commitments of future U.S. cash flows. That's you. That's you. We're promising the Chinese that you'll be good for the money. We're putting you in the position of being borrowers, of being answerable to those lenders in China, Saudi Arabia, Russia, wherever, Canada, Japan. That's you. That's you. Which, when you think about it, when we, essentially, we have sold you as hoes of other countries. And if you see what's happening in China, pissing themselves raw because of the students in Hong Kong, and probably ending up doing what they did, the butchers did to the Tiananmen Square students, a couple thousand of them, you might be a little concerned about what they have to say about your future, because they own you. They own me. They own us all, because we owe them all this money that we're borrowing from them. They sold us cheap stuff, and we're really happy to go to Walmart and buy it. But the other side of that is that we have no idea what that future commitment is. Hardly, you go to Walmart, stop and, you know, talk to one of the people at Walmart who's shopping there. Did you know that you're committing the U.S. to decades, possibly centuries, of future obligations that you and your children and your children's children will all have to pay? And they'll answer to those credit, those lenders. We will answer to them. We're trying to get butch with China. Yeah, watch how that works out for us. That's where we stand, okay? That is the framework that almost no one gets. I try to explain this to the average person, and they'll just go bobblehead. You, however, are the educated. Maybe you can do something about it. I doubt it. Oh, sorry, that was harsh. I want you to remember this. I'm going to show you something really interesting in about a week, I think it is. And it's a consequence of this. And it has to do with something that happened at the beginning of your lives that will reverberate forever. But anyway, there's something funny about this. If our trade deficit is going up, in other words, how much more money we're sending to other countries than they are selling, how much they're selling to us versus how much they're, that would be the trade deficit. That is the current account. And it just keeps going up and up and up. It is a mirror image of the capital account. In other words, one is just the other side of the other. Now, interestingly enough, it was so funny because it would have been back in 2004, 2005. Our trade deficits were skyrocketing. Euro dollars were just piling up in the bank, in the foreign banks. And, I mean, it was serious. And so the president at that time, his administration, was trying to put the best light on what was clearly an out-of-control situation. Trade deficits skyrocketing. Foreign central banks collecting American dollars, calling them euro dollars. And so what they did was they did a report on our current position in the global economy. Instead of posting this one, they posted this one because it looks so much better than this one. And no one caught it. Oh, wow, we're doing really well. Look how that current account, that capital account's going down. No, you ho handles. That's going to be the mirror of the one that really matters. Anyway. Keep this in mind. I've got a story to tell you. It's a story that will turn you into conspiracy theorists if you understand what the graph I do is. Yes, go. No, that was that double-sided one. That was the capital account. You see, because as our current account becomes more larger and larger, our capital account goes further and further into negative territory. We're getting money. That's good stuff. That's the whole idea. See, the current account going up means we've got a problem. We're simply importing more than we're exporting. Now, interestingly enough, we actually intend over a long period of time, especially since World War II, we meant for countries to do this to us. We actually wanted them to, and it started out we wanted China to do this too. Because you see, if we let a country import its crap to us, then we export dollars to them, we can dictate their foreign policy. Well, we'll stop taking your goods into our country. Your industries will no longer grow and become mature unless you do what we want you to. You see? And then you won't have American dollars, which you would really like to have so you can invest in America to help your people earn better money. See, that was the whole idea. We did it all over the world. We'd let countries play this game of selling us more than we bought than they bought from us. It was good politics. We could control the world. It was a capitalist version. You see, the communists just brought troops in and shot everyone. We do that only when we have to. You know, we'd rather just control them through their purses, through their industries. And it worked. We had a lot of countries. And if a country got too far, if it started getting feisty with us, well, we kicked their asses. We'd send in the CIA and, you know, hang a bunch of leftists and put a dictator in. We did all over the world, too. Chile was Allende. Guatemala, Panama was Noriega. We did it in Africa. If they get out of hand, start getting feisty, we just kill them. Don't judge us, okay? You've gotten some good stuff out of that. Okay, there are a couple of financial institutions right there. Financial intermediaries, if you will. In other words, some middle person that matches people, institutions, whatever, who need money with those who have money. These are financial intermediaries. That's what all of these are. And I'm going to give you a couple of other ones. The book actually leaves a couple out, but I mean, its list is pretty exhaustive. Where can... Where can you, sir, get money? You can get it from a bank, right? If you have a bank, you can get it from a credit union. But there are a lot of other places where money is there to match some needer with someone who has it. One of those deficit economic units with a surplus economic unit. And I'll write that here. Deficit. I can't write with a darn. Deficit unit and a surplus unit. Now, financial institutions, in other words, deficit, something that needs money. Surplus, something that has money. Now, again, you could be both at the same time. But here in the middle, a lot of times, is a financial intermediary. That's financial intermediation, matching those who have money with those who need money. Retail banks can do that. Now, when I say retail, that's a little bit of a, there's, if you catch it in the way the book explains it, there's almost a fuzzy, it's kind of fuzzy, the difference between a retail bank and a commercial bank. The line is kind of fuzzy, especially anymore. You see, many financial institutions want to be like department stores. You can go there, it's a one stop for different things that you might want to do. Retail banks are sort of like small department stores. Commercial banks are large department stores. So in other words, I could go to, we're here in town. This town is so dead anymore. It used to not be so dead. See, I could go to Kohl's, and I could get socks, shoes. Indeed, I could get a tie that isn't all torn out. There are things that I can get. I can even get, they've got things like by Sharper Image. You know, I could get, like a back massager. I could get linens. I mean, they have pretty good quality. You know, 250 count linen, quilts for the bed, for the and all that. I could probably get some other things there too. I can get chocolates there. But if I really wanted a variety, if I needed a lot of different things, I would go to a Meijer or a Walmart. Or if I didn't need quite so much, I could go to a Target. So there's almost like a fuzziness here. A commercial bank is everything you want. It's all there. You see, we used to not let this happen. For after the crash of 29, in 1932, we got a whole Congress and presidency of hardcore reformers. I mean, really hardcore. And they just kicked the asses of every scammer, con artist, you name it, every in securities, in banking, in labor. I mean, they just cleaned house, put in laws that put fists over them. And one of those was a banking law, and I'll bring this up. You don't have to write it down now, but there was a banking law called Glass-Steagall after the two authors of the act in the 1930s. And that prohibited many of the things that now are being done again that were done that caused such crises in the 1920s. Glass-Steagall was repealed in 1999 in sort of a coordinated agreement between the conservative, right-wing conservatives in Congress and the neoliberal president, Bill Clinton. They said, well, you know, these banks, we promise we won't do that anymore, what they did in the 1920s. Please take these shackles off us. Please, please, please. And, of course, they did. And sure enough, we're back with the same kinds of multi-variety, promise you can do anything there, financial institutions we had that caused so many of the problems in banking in the 1920s. Anyway, there is kind of a fuzziness. I would certainly never test you. Well, which of these is can a commercial bank do that a retail bank can't do? That, I mean, it's just like, God, I know regulators who couldn't tell you really anymore. Okay, now, other financial intermediaries, matchers of surplus and deficit economic units. And there are so many different ones, it's just kind of ridiculous. Pension funds. Pension funds get money from people paying into their pension plans, and then they have to do something with that money. They have to invest it. Insurance companies, especially life insurance companies, are massive investors in bond markets. I mean, they are the big place. They get in all these insurance premiums. They have to do something with them. And they have to... I've told you this before, but I want to do it again. Ma'am, did you know you're going to die? Tomorrow? Well, I certainly hope not. Now, it could happen. You could walk out of here and some random train come, ding, 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 ding. That could happen to you. Or a meteorite could hit you. The head, boom. But it probably won't. You'll probably live to, possibly to your late 90s, early 100s in your time. Which is kind of funny, considering how crappy the world will be. But anyway, you see, insurance companies, life insurance companies, cannot invest. They don't want to invest in short-term things, like certificates of deposit, like commercial paper. They need long-term investments. Well, stock goes forever. Do they invest in that? Not really, because stock is risky. And they need to know that they're going to have the money to pay when you do die. Okay? So they are massive players in the bond markets, in the high-quality bond markets. They just shovel billions of dollars investing in corporate debt. High-quality, AAA, AA, single A. They are the ones who walk up and say, we will take that when the investment bank says we need to sell. We bought these bonds from this company that needed to borrow money. Now we're selling them out. Well, the insurance company stepped right up to the plate. Sometimes they don't even use investment banks. They have proprietary arrangements. Oh, you're going to issue $100 million in bonds? Well, we'll just take them right off your hands. Here's $100 million. And so it's life insurance companies. However, property and casualty companies do too. Madam, have you ever been in an earthquake? Okay, I have a couple of times. They were very mild ones. Did you know that right here, we're near ground zero for one of the places that has had some of the worst earthquakes in the Americas? There's a fault line called New Madrid. It's east of here. But the thing about it is that you've probably never heard of it because it lets go maybe every 200 to 500 years. The last time that it let go was in the early 1800s. The letters that were written by people of the time in the St. Louis area, it was literally like reading science fiction apocalypse literature. They describe burning buildings, dead bodies, smoke pouring out of everywhere. And the earthquakes kept coming and coming. Not aftershocks, full blown, and then the aftershocks. One of them was so violent that the story was the Mississippi River ran backwards. No, the shock threw the Mississippi River water that was heading south. It threw it in a giant wave back north. And then it came back down like a tidal wave south, wiped out farmland, flooded out everything on its way down. It was one of the writers of the time said, when they heard the water coming that night, he said, I could hear a voice in it. The voice said, I'm a-coming. and it just obliterated everything. They were already, the city was wiped out. The Native Americans, in their legends, had described another one of these that we've tracked probably was about 500 years ago. We're on it. So, you know, you might want to, you know, like, I don't know how you can prepare. Maybe put some springs under your bed. I don't know. You know, an umbrella underneath the ceiling. I don't know. But anyway, you see, those happen so rarely that the companies that do earthquake insurance would certainly want to have investments that aren't going to pay back for a long, long time because they don't need the money for a long, long time. So you see, these long-term events have that kind of profile and therefore call for investors whose timing is extraordinarily long-term. Funny story about the World Trade Center. When during the attacks on September 11th of 2001, they blasted the first tower down, and then they chopped through a hard direct hit on the second tower. And horrible loss of life, just ungodly. But interestingly enough, only one of the World Trade Towers of the two was insured. Why? Why would they have insured only one? Well, think about it. I mean, the probability of a skyscraper like that ever falling to the ground would be insanely low. The probability of two of them, that couldn't possibly have ever happened. Well, it did. There's a famous story. I was driving along one night, and I saw some hitchhiking kid, you know, snot-nosed, greasy, hadn't bathed in a while. And I pick him up, and he gets in, and he's just exhausted. He's tired. He said, no one would pick me up. Thank God, you know. Everyone probably, driving by, not picking me up, thought I was an axe murderer, you know, some kind of serial killer. And I just laughed at him, and I said, what's the chance that there'd be two serial killers in the same car? He was so quiet. Anyway, other ones in this, of course, there are the investment banks. There are these investment banks. Of course, they have their clients who put money in, and then they use that money to buy the stock of public offerings to sell back to their clients. That's pure, perfect financial intermediation. It's on a level that you will never see. Yeah, go ahead.
Is insurance companies a part of the pension funds?
Oh, no. Interestingly enough, there is a distinction. Now, you are right that sometimes insurance companies do oversee, manage, or have subsidiaries that are pension funds. But technically, there is a distinction between them. But you're right. Some pension funds are in some way related, but there's still a technical boundary between them. And the rules that would govern what a pension fund could invest in would possibly, well, quite likely, be somewhat different from the rules that the insurance company could invest in. So, for example, an insurance company might be able to invest in slightly higher risk bonds, like single A or B, but the pension fund would most definitely be throttled, could not do that. As a matter of fact, there's an interesting point there, is that these state pension funds all over the country are coming apart. Even private corporate pension funds are in serious trouble. You know, you probably know about the one here in Illinois. What you don't know about is that this is all over the country, and it's not just public pension plans. The problem was that they calculated the defined benefits of retirees who had worked and paid into the pension fund based upon earning from those pension premiums about 8%. The problem was that the rules of those pension plans prohibited them from investing in things nearly risky enough to earn 8%. We're talking more like 3%. So in other words, they were creating future obligations, assuming 8% growth of the pension premiums being put on, in, when all they could do by the rules of the pension fund was put it in, was invested at about 3%. Hence, it's an enormous crisis. And thank God, you will be taxed, you'll have the whoopee-doo taxed out of you to cover my pension. Actually, no, you won't. My pension right now, I think I get $118 a month if I retire in 17 years. Okay. Other ones that are in here. I mean, it's oh, okay, here's an oddball. Mutual funds and ETFs. I told you about those in the last lecture. These take money. You buy stock from in an ETF. You're putting money in, and then that money goes to companies that sell stock to raise equity capital. Ditto for mutual funds. They do the same thing. So, I mean, it's just like, and then there are all these things. I'm trying to remember. Like I said, the book, I wouldn't beat you up with a list of all the different things. Couple of them. Hedge funds and the evil of the universe, private equity firms. Sir, if you had a choice between being sent to hell and doing a deal with a private equity fund, hell is not that bad. I got a condominium on the third level. It's right by the Bill Clinton golf course. And I mean, on the sixth level below me, there's the Trump Enterprises, but I mean, there's three levels that buffer the sound of screaming souls. The bottom line is, here's how these cats work. Let me give you an idea. They were behind the collapse of Sears. How it works is like this. You, sir, are the CEO of a corporation. You've seen your sales lagging. This is not a financial issue as much as it is you just never kept up with the times. You ever go into a Sears store? It smells just like my grandmother. Seriously. I mean, I think they keep my grandmother's clothes still on rack 3 over there. Paisley. Boy, that was a real kicker in 1910. JCPenney suffered the same fate. It was a lack of innovation. Sears was the inventor of the freaking catalog in the 1800s. Who better would have been positioned in terms of skill sets to have confronted the internet as an enterprise zone? And yet they didn't. They just died. Okay, you're the CEO of Sears, and I come to you. I can save you. Here's what we're going to do. You get in bed with us. We're going to match you with money. We're going to get you loans. Hundreds of millions of dollars in capital that you desperately need. So we're going to get you $500 million. We're going to keep $100 million of it for ourselves, consulting fees. You're also going to give us stock in your company. Lots of stock in your company. Okay? And then what we're going to do is we are going to take over management. First thing we're going to do is get rid of all of these things you're buying here in the United States and move all of your suppliers over to Guangdong province in China. We're going to take care of that. Don't worry. We've got the arrangements made. Don't thank us. And then what we're also going to do is we're going to get our own marketing people in here and all this kind of stuff, and we're going to restructure your corporation. You're now loaded with a lot of debt, so we've got to make sure that we get paid, you know, on time. And then we're going to make the announcement, Sears is back in business. Our stock goes up in price, so we're going to sell that out. And then when you find out that you've got so much in interest payments to pay us, You didn't even get $500 million, but you're paying interest on $500 million. You're going to go tap City. And that's when we just step in. We're the bondholders. You didn't pay us. We take over the corporation. It's ours. We liquidate it, and we move on to our next target. That's how private equity firms work. They are nasty as hell. They use this thing that is real hot called financial engineering to do their tricks. And Staples, Sears, you could go across the graveyard of corporations in modern America, and you could find out that a whole lot of them were behind the scenes private equity funds that set them up for long-term failure. That's how it works. They are sons of bitches, and they pay very well, so you ought to consider getting into that. You know, ditto for hedge funds. Interestingly enough, I ran into another one. I decided I'd open another brokerage account with Fidelity. It was kind of between TD America. I'm not endorsing any of them. But Fidelity just kind of, it just kind of caught me off guard. Would you want a brokerage account? I put money in, and then I can trade stocks. And this one is going to be what's called a side bet, where I go do special things that I've heard or I suspect are going to pop. I don't want them in my main portfolio because they'd throw it way out of balance. But anyway, so here it comes. Well, do you want just a brokerage account? Yes, please. Well, we could also provide you with a checking account. Wait, what? That's a bank thing. A checking account. Would you also like to have a retirement account too? You do all these? You're doing retail banking with a side of brokerage. Now, obviously, their main thing is brokerage, but they do mutual funds. They do brokerage accounts. They do traditional demand deposits. I'm not even sure if it's demand deposits, though. It's like, that was why we did Glass-Steagall, was to keep that kind of nonsense from getting started. But it's the way it's done now. And so it's like a one-stop. They would even give me a Visa debit card. And I mean, that'd be kind of cool. Here's my Fidelity debit card. I'll use that today. Ha, ha, ha. Now, anyway, I'm going to give you a pop quiz now. Now, put your name on it, and if you have your UID, do that as well. And there is your dinner. When you're finished, that's all I have for you today. I thank you.